Thank you so much. Good morning. Some of that bio is a little surprising, but good morning. Good to be here. We only have a brief time to be able to talk together about this wonderful topic of halacha and Torah values confronting modern business practices. And it's such a world, it's such a universe, and we only have this brief time together. So we tried to find a topic that would include many different dimensions to it. Rabbi Charka and I, when we talked about what to discuss this morning, so we tried to find a sugya that on the one hand would be somewhat practical, on the other hand would give us a little bit of a window into seeing how the halacha views the worker-employer relationship. We would be able to get a little bit of a perspective and where there's a difference between the actionable letter of the law and the spirit of the law, the ethical component, and where different elements of how we relate on a day-to-day basis to each other all kind of converge and impact on each other in different ways. And that's how, after a little bit of back and forth, we came up with this topic, which we entitled A Broken Employee Agreements, Revenge, and Lashon Hara in the Marketplace. And I think it's really a fascinating topic that gives us an opportunity to hopefully touch on all those different dimensions that we just mentioned, and we'll hopefully have all of those opportunities together in the next few minutes. So if you take a look at the Mar Makomos sheet, so if you look towards the end, so there is the last item on the Mar Makomos is based on the first item. The first item is the Gemara. It's not all of the Gemara, it's a little bit of Mishnah. The Gemara is much longer, but we just gave a little bit of the tip of the iceberg. But this section of the Talmud is brought l'halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the last Mar Makom here, Mar Makom 6. So I'd like to discuss mostly halachos that emerge from that section of the Shulchan Aruch. We're told there in Shin Lamed Gimel Aleph in Choshen Mishpat, Hatsocher es ha-polim. If somebody hires polim. So first of all, what are polim? So polim are workers, but the halacha distinguishes between different type of workers. So we have a poel, for example, and we have, let's say, a koblin. Koblin is a word very much in use today. We know we use that to mean a contractor. And for the most part, the difference is that a koblin will do a specific task. You'll give him a job. You have a delineated mission for him to accomplish. That's what a koblin is going to do, however long it takes, whenever he decides to do it, within some kind of reasonable predetermined time frame. That's what a koblin does. But a poel works by the clock. So whether that means that you pay him for his time, or whether it also means that he has to do the work at a specific time. Unlike a koblin, the koblin can say, listen, at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's when I'm my freshest. I have time on Sunday mornings, so I can do my work then, and you'll get it, and it'll be fine. A poel rents out his time, so to speak. He hires out his time. He gets paid, let's say, by the hour. And he has to do that work at a specific time. You could have, theoretically, one without the other, and that's an interesting discussion, whether or not that's called a poel. You could have somebody who's paid by the hour, but gets to choose when those hours are. And you could also have someone who's doing a mission, but has to do that mission around a certain time. So, for example, in the second category, you could have, let's say, a taxi driver. A taxi driver has to get you to a location. He gets you there quicker, all the better. We don't pay him for the specific time. But if he's not there when you need to go, then that's going to be a big problem. So you could have, theoretically, one element without the other. So there's somewhat of a discussion how exactly we pin down what's a poel and what's a koblin. But for our purposes, a poel is somebody whose work is defined by the time element. Is probably paid by the hour, has to work at a specific time. That's a poel. So let's say somebody goes up to a worker or a group of workers and says, listen, I have a job for you on Monday. I want you to do this job. So what happens if they end up changing their mind? Either the employer changes his mind or the worker changes their mind. So then what happens? So the language, the Shulchan Aruch here, it's interesting. Again, this is based on the Mishnah you see in Source 1. Hasocher es ha-polim v'hitu es bal habayis, or bal habayis hita osam. So that language of hitu sounds like actually it means deceived. So that's possibly powerful language. We're not going to translate it exactly like that right now, but maybe there's a reason why we use a charged word like that. But for now, let's say in a little bit of a softer sense, they disappointed each other. They changed their minds. So the employer said, you know what, forget it. I don't want you guys to do this job. Or the worker said, you know what, we're not showing up. So somebody changed their mind on the other. So what's the story? So there are going to be many exceptions to this next line, as we'll see. But the baseline ruling is, Ein lohem ze al ze ela tarumas. All they have against each other is tarumas. What does tarumas mean? That's something we'll have to come back to in a few minutes. For now, we'll translate it just for convenience as a grievance. They have only a grievance against each other. What that means, again, we'll come back in a few moments. But if all they did, if all that happened was, I said, would you work for me? Or you said, can I work for you? And we changed our minds on each other, there isn't really any significant halachic consequence. However, if you look at the second halach in Sif Beis, so says the Shulchan Aruch, Bameh Devar Mamurim, that's what Beis Dalet Aleph means. Bameh Devar Mamurim, when is all of what we said true? We skipped a lot, but whatever was in that first section, when is that true? She'ein Lahem Olav Ela Tarumis, that the only consequence is a grievance. When is that the case? B'shalah Holchu, that this is true if they haven't started the job yet, which is also something maybe we'll discuss. So when is it true that there's no real consequence? Davka b'shulhayu yicholim lahaskir atzmam emesh kishescharam balabayis. Only if it doesn't really make a difference to their income one way or another. So let's say, for example, yesterday, emesh, they wouldn't have had another opportunity to get a job. So when you said, I'm going to hire you on Monday, you didn't deprive them of any opportunities because nobody else was going to hire them for Monday. So if it wouldn't have made a difference, there wasn't anyone else who would have hired them, so then there are no consequences. Again, whether it be no consequences or minor consequences is also something we'll have to get to. But this statement is only true if you didn't deprive them of an opportunity that they otherwise would have had yesterday. Aval, v'hayu niskar memesh. But what if yesterday there was an opportunity? Yesterday there was a job they could have taken. And they didn't take it because you said you were going to hire them. V'achshav einan niskarim klal. And hey, there's no more work. Now, because they passed up the opportunity, there's no one else who's going to hire them. No one else is looking. Harei zeh kedavar ha'avud lahem. That's considered to be something that's a real matter of loss for them. V'nosein lahem scharam kipolel batel. And the employer has to actually pay them. Doesn't pay them a full rate. Pays them a rate kipolel batel, which means a worker who's not working, a worker who's idle, which is a lower rate. We're not going to actually compensate you as if you're actually doing all of the labor. There is a benefit to being able to sit at home and do nothing. So we will give a different rate. The Taz writes on the side of the page, it's a 50% rate. Others say that it's more complicated than that. It depends on the circumstance. But somehow we come up with a lower rate for an idle worker, and that's what the worker should be paid if they missed an opportunity. If they otherwise could have gotten a job, and today they can't, we need both factors to be there. Yesterday there were possibilities, today there aren't any possibilities. They lost out because they thought they were going to have a job. So then they do have to get paid. So what do we see so far? So we see, again, I skipped a lot. There are all kinds of qualifications and details. Again, we only have so much time today to share together, so we have to focus a little bit. But in broad strokes, what have we seen? That if you have an employer or an employee, either way, who changes their mind on the other, if there's no actual loss of opportunity or loss of money, then all we have is tarumas. All we have is grievance, and we have to come back to figure out what that means. But if there is a lost opportunity, in this case we're talking about the employer to the employee could have gotten hired yesterday and now no longer has any further work opportunities, so now the employer has to pay this reduced rate. So it's interesting to ask, what's the chiddush here? What's the more surprising statement? What would you have thought? Would you have thought that there should be an obligation here? There shouldn't be an obligation. The first case, there should be an obligation. There shouldn't be an obligation. What's the baseline? What's the normal expectation? It's not such an easy question. Right, what would you have thought about this situation, let's say the second situation? that we expect the employer to pay something. Is that obvious? Is that intuitive? Is that the normal halacha? So that's actually not so simple. Because the normal rule we have is that if I damage your property, I cause you a monetary loss, I take a sledgehammer and I break your windshield on your car, so then I have to pay. That's called mazik. I am damaging your property actively and physically. I have to pay. But what if I do it indirectly? I don't actually physically harm your car. I do something else that causes you to have less money. And even more so, I don't actually cause you to have less money that you already have, but I stop you from making more money, called menias hareva. If I do something that prevents you from making money, so am I normally obligated to pay you for that? So the answer is probably no. That's called, on the surface, grumma benezikin, that the nezikin, the harm that happens here, is causational. It's not something I did directly. It's also very hard to predict and to assess what would have happened had I not done whatever I did. So the normal baseline halach is you're actually not obligated to compensate the person who loses out because of that. Now that doesn't mean it's a good idea, and it doesn't mean that it's permitted. There is probably, most likely, a prohibition associated even with indirect damages, even if in a roundabout way you're causing somebody to lose money they have or not make money they otherwise would have made. We're not saying that this is something you're allowed to do, but this might be our first example of a gap between what you are allowed and not allowed to do on the one hand and what's actionable in Beis Din, what can be collected in court. So okay, so fine, it wasn't nice, but it's not so clear why this should be anything you should have to pay for. You should have to compensate the workers for. Okay, they lost out an opportunity. It wasn't nice to do that to them. But as far as Choshen Mishpat is concerned, as far as monetary law governs, normally that's not a debt you can collect. Normally the workers shouldn't be able to ask for payment under those circumstances, one would think. So why does the Shulchan Aruch say what it says? That seems to be surprising. Should say, okay, there isn't any salary here. There's no job, there's no work, there's no salary. Not like an idle worker, like any other worker. So why does the Shulchan Aruch say that he's got to pay up? So this was a topic, sorry? But that's, again, why there's a prohibition. And so we'll talk about that a little bit more. So again, it was wrong of the boss to do this. But the consequence doesn't seem to be one that normally fits monetary law. Okay, we agree he did something not nice, but to say you should have to pay for it, that's a chiddush. So the Ksos on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, if you have the right kind of edition, the Ksos is one of the most well-known of the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat. So the Ksos HaChoshen writes that he thinks it's not so obvious that one should have to pay under those circumstances. It does seem to be causational. And he notes that there are Rishonim who differed with this view that the Shulchan Aruch quotes and says that this is not the kind of circumstance you have to pay for. This is indirect. And he's not sure why this is necessarily the conclusion of the Shulchan Aruch, because there are those who disagree. Now, what's the consequence of there being those who disagree? As the later authorities point out, okay, it's interesting conceptually that there are those who disagree, but the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote those opinions. And bottom line, it seems like there is an obligation. Sometimes when there's an argument in monetary law, there's an advantage given to the mukhsak, the one who's holding on to the money already. That one has the upper hand usually in monetary law. So he could say, listen, it's a point of dispute. It's an argued point whether or not I have to pay you. So I have the right to say I follow the opinion that says I don't have to pay. So you might say, okay, the boss can say, all right, there's a dispute about this. It's an argument whether or not I really have to pay these workers. So I'm holding on to the money already. I'm the mukhsak. I'm going to keep it. So the later authorities say, no, if it's not even quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, he doesn't have such a right. If that opinion doesn't make it to the page over here, so that's not within his rights. Sometimes you say like that, but not here, because the Shulchan Aruch doesn't adopt that position at all, even as something to consider. So why is the Shulchan Aruch so sure that there is an obligation here? It doesn't even quote the dissenting opinion, which we would have thought maybe is the more likely opinion. So there are many who suggest that maybe this isn't your typical grama. When we talk about something that's causational, that's grama, so we find sometimes a very subtle distinction in the halakhic literature. It's extremely subtle, it's hard to translate it, that we find the word grama and garmi, which sound like they basically mean the same thing, and they might be the same thing. But apparently, garmi is a form of grama where you're more directly involved, where there is room to have some liability. Grama, maybe you're exempt, but if you're in this more intense category of garmi, so then maybe with a different rule, and maybe there should be some compensation. So now it's an interesting question. So why is this different than a normal causational situation? Why are we calling this garmi rather than grama? So if you look on the bottom of the Rush, in the back of the Gemara, it's a commentary called the Pilpul HaCharifta. We didn't put everything on the sheet, but if you look over there. So there he suggests that maybe when it comes to these daily workers, so there's always somebody who needs something, so it's more of a vadai, it's more of a definite situation that had you given them enough notice, they would have found work. And it's only because you're doing this at the last minute that now they're not going to have opportunities to find work. So this is different than any other causational situation. In a different causational situation, who knows what would have happened if you hadn't interfered, who knows what profit would have come to this person. But with these daily workers, you could say that it's likely enough that they would have gotten a job if you had given them enough warning, enough time to find one. So therefore, this is more of a direct damage than you otherwise find. While there are other suggestions, perhaps even more interesting, in the Sefer Melo HaRoim, he suggests that there's something unique about a poel. This idea of the daily worker, or the hourly worker, the worker who essentially sells their time, so that has a unique status in halacha. We're very careful with the poel. The Torah tells us we have to be particularly careful not to delay payment to a poel. The Torah says that we're afraid that a poel may turn into a slave, so we give the poel the upper hand that he can pull out with more unilateral authority, because we don't want this to turn into essentially slavery once you're selling your time. We have all kinds of rules as far as respecting the time and the dignity of the hourly worker. So maybe that's what we're saying here, that this is more of a direct assault on that dignity if you're saying that you're going to be casual with the time of the poel. So then that's really an act of direct harm, and that's not the kind of thing that we're going to let you off the hook for. That we're going to be a little bit stricter about, and we're not going to see this as causational, we're going to see this as something more significant. The Ketos HaChoshen himself, who questioned this whole idea, so he mentioned a different suggestion, that we know also in the Torah that there is the concept of sheves, that if one inflicts bodily harm on someone, so by Torah law, not all of which is enforced today for various reasons, but there are five different standards, five different metrics that we use to assess how much one should be compensated if they are harmed, if they're injured by someone else. So one of them is called sheves, the fact that they're not able to work because of their injury. So that's also something the person who inflicted that harm has to pay for. So the Ketos writes, maybe that's the story here, that since the Torah itself specifically said that when you stop a poel from working, you have to compensate them for that, so maybe that's what's going on here also. This is somehow in the category of sheves. So that's a tricky suggestion, because others criticized it. They pointed out that Ketos himself recorded some of the objections. They note that that's true when you actually inflict harm on the person, you have such a concept of sheves, and also it's limited once they are able to work, so then you're no longer obligated to pay them. And also, as I alluded to a minute ago, we don't actually enforce sheves nowadays, because sheves might be in a category called a knas, called a penalty. It's a little bit of a debate. And the contemporary Beis Din, where we don't have smuchim, we don't have judges who were ordained from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, so we are limited in how much we can enforce. So if we're going to trace it all to sheves, it's not clear that this din in Shulchan Aruch would even be practiced nowadays. So there are many reasons to question whether or not this is going to be a viable theory. Is this something that is going to work to explain what's going on? There's another theory that suggests there's kind of a bilateral relationship here between the employer and the employee. That we find, the Gemara is eventually going to tell us, if we had enough time, that even though the employee has the right to pull out, But that's limited if the employee has exposed the employer to damage. Let's say he started the work already, and now everything is exposed and open and it can't be quickly put away, and there's going to be monetary loss to the employer, so then the employee is not necessarily allowed to do that. And why is that true? That's the whole discussion. We have to come back to talk about that. But some suggest that maybe there's a bilateral relationship here, that anything that actually causes a loss to the other, the employee causes a loss to the employer causes a loss to the employee by their going back on each other, and maybe this is an institution Chazal put in place and said there's going to be liability there. Even if it doesn't follow the normal rules of damage, maybe this is a suggestion that there is such an institution of the rabbis, and that's why in both directions there's going to be liability. There are others. Hi. So that's a good question. Let's get a little bit more background first and see how much we have time to cover, because these are important questions. So there is another suggestion that maybe this should be traced to a fascinating view of the Ritva. The Ritva has a comment on a Gemara, where the Gemara says, at least initially, whether this is the conclusion of the Gemara is a different story, but the Gemara says, let's say somebody wants to get a good deal on a bottle of wine. And there's a certain place, Zulshaft, the Gemara talks about, where they have wine, at certain times they have it at a cheaper rate. So you could go yourself and buy the wine, but you have a friend who's able to go. So you say to your friend, will you go pick me up a good bottle of wine? Then it turns out he doesn't do it. So now, for you to buy wine, it's going to cost you more. He missed the opportunity to get it at the good rate. So it sounds like from the Gemara, it's a question bottom line, that maybe this messenger, this emissary, should have to make up the difference in the cost between the cheaper wine and the more expensive one. So why? Why is that his liability? So the Ritva has a suggestion, one of the great Rishon in the Ritva has a suggestion in that Gemara, that if somebody does something, and somebody spends money because of that, or loses money because of what the other person is doing, so then there is a trust there, and that creates a liability. So in this case, the man trusted his worker and said, okay, you're going to pick up the wine for me, therefore I won't get the wine myself. So he put that trust in the worker, that creates a enforced relationship, and now whatever loss comes back to him, even an opportunity cost perhaps, that is something that there's a liability for. Because the initial person relied on him. He said, okay, I'm not going to go myself, you'll pick it up for me. So therefore now there's a monetary liability, which is a fascinating idea. It's debated among poskim whether or not it's true. I remember thinking about this many years ago. Nowadays, right now, in current events, so we're involved in a very contentious presidential election, and there are one or two people out there who wishes there was a third option. And the last time there was a serious third party opponent in a presidential election was Ross Perot in 1992. And if you recall, so he ran as a third party candidate, and then he withdrew. And then he came back again. So when he withdrew, there was a woman in Florida who worked for his campaign who initiated a lawsuit against him. She said that so many people spent so much time and money because he said he was going to run if he was on all 50 states, and now he's pulling out, he disappointed everyone, so she sued him. She eventually withdrew the lawsuit, but that was the initial response. So I remember thinking at the time that maybe that's like the Ritva, that the Ritva is saying that, oh, if you spend money and effort based on what I say I'm going to do, and then you end up losing it because I changed my mind, so then maybe there's some liability there. So that's another suggestion that maybe that's what's going on. So in any event, what do we see? So we see a couple of possibilities to explain why, even though the normal bottom line should be, if I cause you to lose money, or especially if I cause you to lose an opportunity, I shouldn't be obligated by the letter of the law to pay for it. Nonetheless, here the Shulchan Aruch says, you do, at least on some level, at least like an idle worker. And the question is why? And we saw a couple possibilities. We saw the Tzos who questioned the whole thing. Maybe the letter of the law shouldn't be this way. Right? We saw the possibility that maybe this is a more definite kind of damage because the worker would have very likely found the job otherwise. we saw the suggestion that maybe this has to do with the nature of what it means to be a poel, to be a time-based worker, and there's a greater sensitivity within Jewish law to that situation. We saw the possibility that maybe it has to do with the halacha of sheves that we find in the Torah, the consequence one has to take on if they physically hurt someone and keep them from being able to work. We saw the possibility that maybe this is a bilateral institution of davar ha'avud, that if you cause a loss for somebody else, employer-employee in either direction, there's a liability for that. Or maybe it's based on the ritva, on this idea that if somebody acts based on your say-so and ends up suffering for it, that maybe there should be a liability for that. So all of that is interesting just in terms of the concept. In practice, it gets difficult because in practice, the worker, in this case, is going to have to make a compelling case. If he's going to come to Beis Din and he's going to say, I want to be compensated for this work I didn't get, for the work I didn't do for this guy. So since the Shulchan Aruch said, it's all premised on the assumption that he had job opportunities yesterday, and he doesn't have job opportunities today. So clearly there's a lot to argue about that. So what opportunities did he really have yesterday? The boss will say, oh, I was the only one who was nice to you, I'm pretty sure nobody would have hired you, I'm the first person who came along. Or he'll say, today, if you really worked harder, you'd be able to find something. You're just coasting off this idea that you can come and make a claim against me. There's clearly a lot that's very arguable here. So there is a big burden on the worker. The worker is going to have to come to Beis Din and is going to have to be able to establish that the two premises here are correct, that there was a job opportunity yesterday and there's no job opportunity today. So that's somewhat of a high burden. So it's difficult for this to happen in practice. But the poskim also write, there are many beautiful svarim out today on the laws of Poland, a sefer called Mishpatei Achoshen, a particularly beautiful sefer. So they point out that yes, it's true that there's a big burden of proof on the worker in this case to establish that these facts are true, but if the employer believes him, if the employer says, you know, it does make sense that I realize that there were jobs yesterday and I know it's harder today, and he realizes that there's truth to what he's saying, so even if Beis Din can't necessarily enforce that in the absence of proof, but that does create a moral obligation. That does mean that Lotzeis Lidei Shamayim, if one wants to be square with God, so he recognizes that he did create this loss, so then, like the Shulchan Aruch says, the debt is theoretically there, and the employer should pay it, even if the proof isn't there for the Beis Din to compel them to do it. There was a little article I noticed. I don't think we can't have a Yom Iyun about business and halacha without mentioning the name of Mori V'Rabbi, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rabbi Levine was a tremendous Talmid Chacham who was the head of the economics department here in NYU when I was in college, and who did so much to further the field of business and Jewish law. It's very, very influential books and teaching overall. So he had an article a number of years ago where he talked about another lawsuit, where there was a situation where a rabbi was sued. For coming late to a wedding, and they claimed that because it was an hour and a half late, and they said all kinds of terrible things happened because everyone was waiting around for an hour and a half, and the guests ended up eating more food, and they got drunk, and they argued, it's all his fault for coming an hour and a half late. So he has a whole discussion about whether or not there really is liability. Not surprisingly, he didn't think there was a liability for the rabbi for that, but in the context, a brief article, but in the context of that, he talks about some of these concepts. He talks about the question, for example, of a doctor who books appointments, and then if the patient doesn't show up for the appointment, so the doctor says, I'm going to charge you for the appointment anyway. I don't know what the medical school policy is. But so there he notes that it's unlikely that that's going to make the cut halachically, that the doctor claiming that they lost income because the patient didn't show up, he takes it as a given. Again, I don't want to judge the doctor, but he takes it as a given that the doctors overbooked the patients already, so there's always a lot of patients waiting in the waiting room, so that they didn't really lose out an opportunity because the patient didn't show up this time or that time. So on the one hand, he didn't think that there was actual liability there, that the doctor would actually be able to take this guy to Beis Din and say that you have to pay for the missed appointment. However, an interesting pshara, he said that for the doctor to make a statement when they may give out the appointments, and they say, if you don't come for your appointment, you don't give us enough notice, we're going to charge you, He says, even though the claim may not be valid halachically, he thinks it's still a valid thing to say, which is interesting because, again, Rabbi Levine was a big tzaddik and was very, very careful about all issues of honesty. But here he maintained that even though the claim may not necessarily be valid, it's there to motivate responsible behavior by the patients. And if all the patients decided not to show up, that certainly would create a noticeable, demonstrable loss to the doctor. So therefore, to make this as a general statement that we have this policy that you can't cancel on us and that we'll enforce it, whether or not they'll actually succeed in collecting that money is irrelevant, to make this claim that he thought it was a legitimate approach for the doctor and was in the realm of honest behavior for him to make this claim and to say that this is the rule for broken appointments. But in any event, so all of this, as we see, this is really the first half of our discussion, so this is all true if, or potentially true, or true in a complicated way, if there is a loss to the employee and the employer, or either direction. If somebody misses out because of the reversal, so then that's where we got into the whole discussion that we just had. But what if there's no loss? What if the worker is able to find another job, or the employer is able to find other workers, so there isn't any actual monetary consequence, even in terms of an opportunity cost to either party, so then what's the story? So that's where we go back to the first system, Shulchan Aruch, where the bottom line is, Ein lo alav ela tarumis. If there isn't anything that actually monetarily happens between the two of them, so then all there is grievance, or annoyance, or irritation, however you want to translate tarumis. So how you translate it is a big question. What does that mean? What is the Shulchan Aruch telling us? It's based on the Mishnah, it's based on a phrase that appears a number of times in similar contexts throughout the Talmud, that there's this concept of tarumis. What are we saying? What exactly is the message? It's a hard point to understand. What does it mean when we say, Ein lo alav ela tarumis? So some say it means nothing. That's how the Tiferes Yisrael, commenting on the Mishnah, says that the point is that there are no monetary consequences or any other consequences. So we're basically saying, you have a grievance, good, that's all you have. That and 250 will get you on the subway. You don't have anything, you don't have any monetary claim, there isn't anything to collect here, so essentially it's the Mishnah's way of saying that there's nothing. There isn't anything to talk about, all you have is your annoyance. Others, however, assume it's got to be something more than that. That the idea of tarumis, which again appears a number of times, it's not nothing, it's something. It's very vague, but it's not nothing, it's something. So we have to figure out a few things. So what is the something? What is it that it is? And why is it? So if indeed the worker was able to find another job, or the employer was able to find other people to do the work, so why is there anything? Maybe the Tiferes Yisrael should be right. There should be nothing. Okay, there was a change in plans. Things changed, but there was no consequence. So there shouldn't be anything. So there are different suggestions. It sounds like from the tour that we're worried about the torech, that yes, the worker can find, but now he was able to sleep at night knowing he has a job. He could sleep Sunday night knowing he's got a job Monday. Once they got the call Sunday night that the job is canceled, he's going to have to frantically make some phone calls. He's going to have to get on Craigslist or something. He's going to have to spend some time searching around. So that's a little bit of a consequence. Not the kind of thing you can go to Bezdin for and say, I'm all upset that I had to spend this time surfing the internet to find another job. But it's something, okay, it's something that entitles you to be annoyed. Rashi over here suggests that it has to do with the fact that people will talk. All of a sudden, this person had a job yesterday, today he doesn't have a job, so people will wonder, what's going on? How come at first he was on deck to do this, now he's not doing this? And that's maybe something that there should be some justified grievance about. There's another passage in the Gemara, just to quickly summarize, I think we have it here. Yes, Gemara Makom 4, where the Gemara has Tarumas in a different context, and the Gemara talks about, just to summarize what the Gemara is talking about here, that let's say somebody rents out a boat for a journey. He hires a ship and a ship captain to take his cargo. And then halfway through he changes his mind. Halfway through the journey he changes his mind. So Gemara goes back and forth. What does he mean he changes his mind halfway through? Let's say he decided that he's going to keep the boat, he's going to keep this captain, but he's going to load more cargo on. He'll have to pay. He's paying per freight, so he's going to have to pay for the extra freight. But he changed the plan in the middle. He added more cargo. So the Gemara says, so since he's covering the cost, and there isn't any opportunity cost in this case, So all he has is tarumas. So the Gemara asks, well, why is there any tarumas? Everything seems to be pretty much stable. So the ship captain still has his salary, and he still isn't missing any other opportunities. So the Gemara has a suggestion, it's a little bit of a question how to read it, but that there are details that it's going to now take longer because the ship is heavier, and he thought that he had a certain picture in his mind of how long this trip was going to be, and now it's going to take longer. So there are differences. All of a sudden things changed from the agreement, so that's a basis of annoyance. Tosfos suggests differently than Rashi, that maybe he sold the cargo in the middle to somebody else. Not that he added more cargo, but that he transferred the ownership of the cargo to somebody else. Now the ship captain has to deal with a different person. He had just gotten used to dealing with this guy, who says he wants to deal with somebody else, so he's annoyed about that. So whatever it is, it's not an actual monetary cost, but it's some type of impact on some kind of a immeasurable level, like all of these references to tarumas. So therefore, there's tarumas. So again, what is tarumas? So what does that mean? What exactly is it? So some suggest that maybe the point is, this is a discussion of Nassim Gestetner, who was a great posek in Bnei Brak, passed away a few years ago, and he wrote a sefer on the Gemara as well, so in his commentary to Maseches Bava Metzia has a nice discussion about this, where he says that maybe the point is that it's wrong. Maybe that's what the Mishnah is trying to say. That, listen, there are some things that are actionable in Beis Din, there are some things that we can go to court and we can enforce, and there are other things that are below the threshold of what we can enforce. But that doesn't mean that it's right. It doesn't mean that it's proper behavior for a nice Jewish person, which is what you mentioned before. So what about their word? If they said they're going to hire you, so even, okay, you were able to scramble the night before and find another job, but it's not right to pull out. It's not right to not stick to your word. We say that Sisa HaYashav HaTov is in notes. The Torah tells us that we have to act in a straightforward and good fashion. We say Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, that the Jewish people will always be honest. And quotes also the pasuk in yesterday's Kriyas HaTorah in Parshas Kedoshim, where we read Hin Tzedek and Chazal read Hein Tzedek, that you should be honest in your yeses and your noes. You should be consistent and straightforward. So for all of those reasons, it's wrong without justification. We could talk about what justification is in a minute, but without significant justification, it would be wrong to change your mind on this individual, and that's what the Mishnah is trying to tell you, that he's right to be upset because what you did wasn't so nice, and it's not the kind of behavior that we really endorse. And to quote another, even more well-known pasuk from yesterday's Kriyas HaTorah, we're also told, that you should love your fellow as yourself. And there's a big discussion in the Rishonim what that means. If you're supposed to love someone else as yourself, so if that's a question of degree, so then that's a big standard. To say that you should do things for other people to the same degree as you do for yourself is practically impossible. So some understand, some of the Rishonim and some of the later Sfarim understand that it's referring to negative behavior. That you shouldn't act to other people the way you wouldn't want them to act to you. That's how Hillel reformulated it in the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos. Ma'adalach sani l'chaderech lo savid, what's hateful to you, you shouldn't do to others. So to hear, you wouldn't want people to all of a sudden change on you with no explanation, with no justification. So too, it's something you shouldn't do to others. And maybe that's the point here, that's just coming to tell you that it's wrong. It's telling you to tell you that it's not proper behavior. So that's actually an interesting question. Is it something that is prohibited across the board? Are there justifications? So some point to, if you take a look at source number 3, this is coming from a totally different area of halacha on the surface. This is actually coming from Hilchos Milah. So you see it's in Yerodeya, Reish HaMachdalet, it's not in the Chosh HaMishpat. It's talking about somebody who hires a mohel, what somebody should look for at a mohel, or what if somebody contracts with a mohel and then changes the mind, etc., etc. So here, the Rama over here, with the middle part is quoted here, about the question of what would happen if one wanted to go back and forth. And the Rama talks about, may or may not actually be in the selection, but the Rama talks about, does it make a difference if the rates change? If there's, maybe it's actually only in the other section here, but the Rama talks about, what if the price goes up or down? So do you have a right to change your decision if the prices change? Or if there are other similar changes in circumstance? So it sounds like the Ramah quotes two opinions about this. One opinion that says that if one changes their mind without justification, it's mechusar amana, they're lacking in trustworthiness, they're faithless, and that's something that we criticize. And the Ramah quotes two opinions, is that true even if the prices change, if the rights change, and there's a reason to take a different attitude, maybe we'll still say that's considered to be faithless behavior, and that's something that we criticize. The Aruch HaShulchan concludes on this point, that if the situation radically changes, that if, let's say, there is no need for the worker anymore at all, or if one finds out that the workers who they contracted with, I shouldn't say contract, the workers who they hired verbally, those workers, they find out that they're completely untrustworthy, or there's some kind of other major change in the situation that totally redefines the whole story, the Aruch HaShulchan writes, that's a different situation, so then we wouldn't necessarily call that faithless. If there's a real substantive change in the story, so then that's a different situation. In the Sefer Pisrei Choshen, the Pisrei Choshen was a very useful and widely read Sefer on Choshen Mishpat. It was written by Rabbi Yaakov Yishaya Bloy, who passed away just a few years ago, wrote many wonderful Svarim on Halacha. So he notes that this often happens with taxis, that you'll call a taxi and you tell the taxi you have to leave at a certain time, and then they don't show up at that time. So you want to call a different taxi. So you have the right to call a different taxi, and this taxi is eventually going to show up, and they're going to say, now I can't get another passenger so quickly, so what category does that fall into? So he assumes in that case, you do have the right to hire another taxi, because you have to get where you're going on time, and you never have any idea when they're going to show up. If they're a few minutes late, maybe they'll end up being hours late, and how are you going to reassess? So this is an example, he writes, of a situation where it's legitimate for the individual to rethink things and to take a different attitude. Okay, so this is one perspective on what tarumas is, that tarumas is something. Tarumas is a statement that it's wrong to change your mind unless there's a good justification, unless there's a basis for it. There are others who suggest that maybe it's a little bit more than that, that it's not just an indication that what the person who changed their mind did is wrong, but it has other implications for yesterday's parsha. So this is the attitude that's taken by the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and a few others, that they suggest that it's mutter l'hisraim belibo, that it's permissible for the victim here, so to speak, to be upset in his heart, to be angry in his heart. So why is that a chiddush? So that's because of yesterday's parsha. Yesterday in Parshas Kedoshim we read, v'losikom v'lositor es b'nei amecha, that somebody who feels other people haven't been so nice to him is not allowed to take revenge. That's losikom, which the Gemara explains means to act to them in the same way that they acted towards you, in the negative sense. And not only that, but lositor. You're not supposed to even bear a grudge. So the Gemara gives an example that, let's say, you want to borrow somebody's property. You want to borrow their lawnmower. And they say, I'm not interested in giving you the lawnmower. So then the next day they come and they ask you, can I borrow your DVD player? So you say, no way. What are you talking about? Yesterday I wanted something from you. You weren't interested. So I'm not interested in lending to you. So the Gemara says, that's revenge. It's a pretty mundane example, which is interesting. The Gemara says, that's taking revenge. While the Gemara then says, let's say it's a similar case, but instead of refusing to lend the DVD player, now you say, yeah, I'll lend it to you, because I'm not a jerk like you. Yesterday I wanted something, you weren't there for me, and today I'll give it to you, because I'm a nice guy, unlike some people I know. So that, says the Gemara, that's Natira. The fact that you're holding on to the grudge, that you're thinking about it, that's considered to be a Torah prohibition. And some of the Rishonim understand that even if you don't say that, but you're thinking that, you're holding on to it, that's still already a Torah prohibition. So if that's the case, maybe that's the chiddush here, that normally you're not allowed to bear a grudge, you're not allowed to hold on to your complaints against somebody. Here, the chiddush is you can, because it's interesting middle ground. You would have said that normally, if I have an actionable claim, okay, so then that's not called bearing a grudge, that's called justice. I can go to a Beis Din and I can press my actionable claim. But normally the space is that either it's something that the Beis Din, the courts, can actually deal with, or if it isn't, you're supposed to let it go. You're supposed to not bear a grudge and hold on to it or try to take revenge. So apparently there's a middle ground. middle ground where the Beis Din can't actually do anything about it, but you're allowed to hold on to it. You're allowed to be upset. So there's an interesting discussion to be had here. So, okay, two questions to ask. One is, why is this an exception? Why is this different from the Torah's rule that we read yesterday? And two, even if we can explain why are we advocating it? So for example, the Gemara says that there's an exception that we talked about, a monetary offense, so to speak. Somebody didn't lend you property, you weren't able to use the lawnmower you needed to use. All right, that doesn't justify taking revenge. But if it caused you real personal anguish, the Gemara says, sorry, the gufa, so then that's an exception. So maybe you could say somehow that this falls into that category, that it's considered to be more personal, it's considered to be an exception to lo sikom v'lo sitor. But even if it's an exception, like the Chafetz Chaim writes in his Sefer on Chafetz Chaim, he writes that it's not something we recommend, because the Rambam doesn't even quote this exception, the Sefer HaChinuch doesn't quote this exception, because, okay, it's basically a concession to human frailty, that when you're personally hurt, it's hard not to bear a grudge. But it's still best, as the Gemara itself says, to get past it. So why would we advocate? Why would we say, by the way, you should know, here's harumas, here's something that you can hold on to. So some suggest that the point here is that the one who did this, the one who changed on the other, not only was it wrong, but they have to ask mechila. They have to try to smooth things over. They have to do something to get the other person calmed down. They have to appease them. And there is a fascinating discussion about this in the Pachad Yitzchak and Yom Kippur. Rav Huttner, in his Machshava writings on Yom Kippur, when he talks about the obligation to ask for mechila, he traces it to this concept of tarumas. He says the point is that sometimes the halacha recognizes that you're justified in being upset, that there is something that happened that annoyed you in a recognizable way. And the whole thing the Mishnah tells us, that you have to ask mechila before Yom Kippur, it means that you have to address people's tarumas. And if people have complaints against you, so then you have to smooth that over. And he suggests, that's also why Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said in the famous Machlokes, we don't have time so much to get into, that if somebody doesn't know what you did, Shaul Salanter talks about if somebody spoke Lashon Hara about somebody in a way that didn't have any impact, nobody listened to him, and the person never found out about it. So Bishwal said you shouldn't ask Mechila in that case. So says Rav Huttner, because there's no Tarumas. They don't know about it. So there's no grievance. And the whole point of Mechila is to remove the grievance. So therefore, that's where that obligation correlates. So that's a fascinating suggestion. This halacha here, this Din in Shulchan Aruch is much more significant than we realize. This is the key to this whole interpersonal foundational obligation of asking forgiveness when we have aggrieved each other. But there is one other fascinating interpretation which I'd like to end with. I think we have a few more minutes, where there's a whole other avenue to pursue. So Dayan Yehuda Solman is a prominent Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, author of the Sefer Darchei Choshen. So he suggests that interpreting this law, that this is explained by a Rashi in Bav Metzia, which I did not put on these marmakomos, but to take my word for it, there's a Rashi in Bav Metzia that says that what is tarumas? Tarumas is to speak about it. Lahotzi dibalav, to tell people about it. So it sounds like it's essentially a heter lashon hara. So that's quite interesting. So why is there a heter lashon hara here? Why is this something that you're allowed to speak about? Now, on the surface, we know that Lashon Hara is permitted when it's for a purpose, when it's what we call toelis, when it's there especially to save somebody from harm. So the Chafetz Chaim talks about this at great length, about the idea of toelis, and the two most famous examples that he starts with, and the two most well-known examples are shiduchim, if somebody's going to marry somebody who's bad for them, who's dangerous for them, so certainly you have to tell them. And business, if somebody's going to enter into a business agreement, a partnership or something like that with somebody who's going to rob from them, somebody who's going to defraud them, so for sure, you have to warn them, you have to tell them about the danger. So is that what's going on here? Is it that kind of toelis? Probably not, because as we see, we're talking about categories where there isn't actual monetary loss, where a person is not really deprived of any money. So it's hard to say that it rises to that level of toelis like we're talking about.
And in fact, the Chafetz Chaim himself has a discussion which was very controversial. Many questioned this. The Chafetz Chaim has a thought. It's not clear what his final conclusion is. He says, let's say you see somebody about to buy something in a store. And the price is fair. It's not exploitative. The person is not being defrauded. They're about to pay a reasonable price. But across the street, they can get a better price. So you want to tell this person, you know what, that item you're about to buy, you go over there, you can get it for a better price. So the Chafetz Chaim is not sure you're allowed to say that. He's not sure that that's not considered to be Lashon Hara. And many, many strongly disagreed with this. They said, what are you talking about? It's toelus, it's purposeful. You're trying to save this person money, you're trying to give them the best deal possible. So what's wrong with telling them that they could go across the street and get a better deal? So there's a lot of literature about this statement in the Chafetz Chaim. And some say maybe it depends on how you say it. Are you saying this place is overpriced, that place is better? Are you disparaging the first store? Are you doing it in an unnecessarily harmful way? There's a lot of discussion about this question of the Chafetz Chaim. But what might be going on here is that the Chafetz Chaim perhaps is assuming that toelus is you can save someone from a predator. If somebody is going to be hurt by someone else, so then you have to warn them that this person is harmful. But if it's just a question of saving a few cents here, a few cents there, there's no victimizer, and there's no victim, there's no actual offense happening, it's just that they'll be a little bit better off going over there, and meanwhile this storekeeper is going to be painted as somebody who's overpriced and is going to have a tremendous loss in business when everyone starts running across the street, and they're not going to be able to support their families, so maybe that's not worth it. Maybe that's not the kind of statement that is justified in the category of toelus. Again, it was a controversial ruling one way or another, but it highlights in the Chafetz Chaim's understanding that when we say toelus, you're saving somebody from harm, we have to figure out what necessarily constitutes harm. Not every benefit, not every advantage is always going to equal saving from harm. So that might then still leave us some room in the middle. And maybe we could say that when we're talking about somebody who's a predator, somebody who's dangerous, okay, so then for sure, absolutely one has to say. And when it's not that, we have to have a different kind of justification. So maybe here we're talking about a different category. Maybe what Tarumas is telling us is that when somebody capriciously changes their mind on you without any justification, somebody just decides to call you up night before and say, you know what, I don't want to have you work anymore, so then that's wrong to do. That's behavior that is not appropriate for a nice Jewish person. And therefore, in order to, I think we almost ran out of time, so I'll have to question afterwards. So therefore, the person who's on the other end of that, the receiving end of that, has the right to try to deflect it, has the right to try to deter that kind of behavior and says, okay, that's what you're going to do? You should know the halacha allows me to be upset. The halacha allows me to tell people about what happened. The halacha allows me to remember this. And that point is not necessarily the same kind of toelus. It's not necessarily so that you'll warn everyone else because it's not reaching that threshold. But the idea is you'll be able to deter that kind of behavior, that people will be more motivated to act properly in the business realm if they know, okay, well, there's all these kind of things I can do, all of these little strategies I could use to make life easier for me, and it's never going to rise to the threshold where they'll be able to take me to Beis Din so I can just do whatever I want. And all right, I'm not a nice guy, but who cares? You can't sue me anyway. So the answer is no, that there is what we can do, that you can still bear a grudge, you can still make it known within the parameters that are reasonable. Sternbach writes in a different context from Moshe Sternbach in his Tshuvas that it means only to the extent that it can deter such behavior and possibly change such behavior, but maybe that's what we're discussing here. And this could perhaps be a basis. The question is often asked, let's say, for product reviews, especially now online. There are many opportunities for one to write a review about a product, about a book, about a show, about a restaurant. So the question is, are these reviews justified in the eyes of halacha in terms of Lashon Hara? So the short answer is, possibly yes, under two categories. That if one is really going to waste their money, if one's really going to suffer in some way, so then it should be considered toelus in terms of protecting them from loss. And on the lower level also, let's say if a business doesn't treat you properly, even if they aren't actually causing you any monetary loss, but if it's unacceptable business practices, so then we find room in the halacha here also to make that known, and also in order to deter that kind of behavior and to set a standard for what should happen as long as it's reasonable, as long as it's directed at keeping that behavior from continuing, then that perhaps could be something that we can condone and that we can understand. Assuming, again, that it's within these parameters, and that's a big if. So that doesn't justify a purely vengeful review. If somebody is angry at his friends, he wants to destroy his restaurant, he'll go online, he'll write all the things that he's angry about. So that would clearly be way out of bounds. But whatever is necessary to keep people honest and to keep people behaving properly, so perhaps we see here some basis for that, even when it's not necessarily within the whole threshold of what would otherwise be called toelis. I often say when talking about some of these questions about Lashon Hara and the questions of things like this, the reviews and newspaper articles and the like, that we should focus less on the big questions and more on the small questions. The question is not whether such things are permitted, that we see sometimes there is a need and a place for such things, but the question is how. One still has to make sure to do so fairly, to do so carefully, to do so within the parameters of what's justified and what's necessary, but within all of that perspective, perhaps there is what to talk about. I know that I'm causing unspecified damages to all of you by keeping you here, so I will just quickly review, and now you can go if you want, but just quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about the din in the Shulchan Aruch, that if a worker pulls out on the employer, or the other way around, if there's any monetary loss in the sense of an opportunity cost, so then the employer has to pay the employee like a poel batel, like an idle worker, and the question was, why does he have to do that if it's only causational? So we discussed various perspectives. Maybe, indeed, you don't, like the Ktos consider the opinion that maybe that's not the bottom line, but the Shulchan Aruch does indeed say it. The question is why, so maybe it's garmi, maybe it's more than just causational, it's more direct, either because the worker for sure would have found other things given enough time, or because the worker is defined by their ability to work and it's a more personal type of offense, or because this is an example of what the Torah calls Sheves, with all of the issues we talked about as far as that's concerned, or maybe this is what we call a Davar Ha'avod, that this is something that's real loss and there's a bilateral institution of the rabbis that there's a payment for that. We mentioned also the Ritva, that if somebody does something on your word and that causes you a loss, or vice versa, so then that's also something that the halacha perhaps recognizes. And we talked about that practically, it's very hard to assess what these damages are, so it's going to be hard for the worker to press his case in Beis Din. But if the employee has this case and the employer recognizes that it's true, even if he can't prove it, so then there's certainly a moral obligation to take up that payment, and that's something that again illustrates the space that we sometimes have. We talked a little bit about Rabbi Levine's article about the doctors, whether the doctor has a real claim against patients who cancel appointments, and even if he doesn't have a real claim, maybe he should still be entitled to make that a policy, at least a stated policy, in order to deter such behavior. And then we talked about the other half of the Mishnah, the other half of the Din here in Shulchan Aruch, that if there's no opportunity cost, so then all there is tarumas, and we talked about what that means. Say all there is tarumas, does it mean, like the Tiferes Yisrael says, that it means nothing, that there isn't anything, or does it mean there is something? And the question is, why is there something? We mentioned some possibilities, either because people will talk, or because it's an effort to get a new job, or because you're changing the rules of the game on them in the middle, and that's going to be an annoyance. So the question is, if there is some justified issue, so what does it mean? So we saw that either it means that's a way of saying that it's wrong to do, that it's a violation of Hein Tzedek, a violation of Yehav Tlarecha Kamocha, a violation of Hayashav HaTov, it's not the way to act. Or maybe it means it's justified to bear a grudge, even the Torah normally prohibits bearing a grudge. Or possibly even more than that, it means you can talk about it, it means you can discuss what happened. So we've tried to figure out, maybe we could understand why this is an instinctive attitude, but why should it be actually sanctioned? And we discussed that when it comes to Lashon Hara, so we find that there is a concept of toelis, you're obligated to save somebody from a predator, but here it doesn't necessarily fall in that category. We mentioned the Chafetz Chaim's question about whether you can tell somebody that they'll get a better deal in a store across the street. Not everything rises to the level of predator and victim, but maybe here we're seeing that if there is unjust behavior, even if it doesn't have actual moral implications, so the halacha does allow you to take steps to deter that behavior, steps that are measured and proportionate and are careful and are fair to deter such behavior. And maybe in that context you can see things like online reviews and the like, again focusing on making sure that all those conditions are in place. Thank you very much. I wish you a wonderful day.
Thank you again, Rabbi Feldman. I just like to let everyone know that next week is the final Kol Yom Rishon program. It's a joint program as well. We also would like to thank the Steinberg family for sponsoring this week's Holy Yom Rishon. Please be aware when you exit the building that there is some fire department activity outside, but don't worry. It's just there's a car that there's some questions about. So please do not be concerned and don't worry. There's no fire here. Thank you.